I am absolutely delighted, and first of all, I have to thank the lady in question for giving so generously of her time this morning. Nolene Blackwell, CEO of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. Nolene, always lovely to talk to you, but unfortunately, we have to talk from time to time, and it's usually about something which is not good.
Yeah, but Donny, it is great that we are talking about things. So we work in an area that people aren't that comfortable talking about, the whole area of sexual violence. Nobody wants to talk about it, nobody at all, even us, but it exists. And I want to thank you and Near FM for being prepared to talk about things as they arise. And like giving people information and an opportunity to think about things that otherwise maybe they wouldn't be able to. So it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, that's very kind of you, Nolene. And as you know, we do like to keep up to speed with things. And we spoke, I think, I'm almost certain that the last time we spoke, Nolene, was in the aftermath of the Belfast rape trial. Now, we must put it out there straight away, and I want to make it quite clear that those involved in that were acquitted. There was no guilty verdicts returned in relation to the Belfast rape trial, so I want to make that very clear from the beginning. But in relation to that, Nolene, when we spoke, there seemed to be a lot of well-intentioned talk coming from certain government departments about procedures and things which would be put in place for rape victims in this jurisdiction. And I'm thinking particularly of the provision of a solicitor for a victim, because in case people don't know, when you are a victim of a rape and it goes into a trial, the scenario, for the purposes of court cases, you stop being a victim and you become a witness. So there was a move at the time, I think, certainly a groundswell of opinion that said that people should be treated as rape victims and they should have somebody in court to speak up for them. Where are we with that now, Nolene?
All right. Well, to roll back a little bit, Donny, then, to Easter of this year, which was when that verdict came out, two government departments recognised that enough wasn't being done to make sure that everybody got a fair hearing in our justice system and that youngsters knew what to do. So two things happened that weekend. One of them was, and I'll come back to the other one in a second because it's what you asked about. The first one was that Richard Bruton, who was then the Minister for Education, he's shifted post at the weekend, but he was the Minister for Education, and he said that he would get the curriculum assessment unit, to look at how consent was taught in schools, because one of the things that became clear was how little consent was involved in some exchanges on the WhatsApps of the rugby players after the trial. Nothing to do with the trial, but just those came out and it was clear that they were, you know, at the very least, highly disrespectful. The second minister who came out, though, was Charlie Flanagan as the Minister for Justice. And we were able to say to him at that stage, very shortly afterwards, we were able to say that as that trial was going on and afterwards, people were phoning the national 24-hour helpline, which we run, and saying they would not give evidence, they would not go to court, they did not like the treatment that was handed out in these cases, and that they felt that the court was a cruel place. But it wasn't only people who were victims that felt that. Everyone who heard what was going on in that case felt that justice wasn't being served for anyone. And particularly, the position of a victim in these sexual violence cases came under scrutiny. And the reality is, when you look at it, in these cases, if the question is, did the complainant consent or not, then what you have, to put it in sort of ordinary language, is a swearing match. She normally, nearly always, says she did not consent. He always, because that's the way our law is, he says she did consent. And what both of them then are doing is presenting their version of events to the jury to make a decision about whether she did or did not consent. And in the case as it stands at the moment, he, the accused, is represented by an expert, experienced criminal law team, senior counsel, junior counsel, solicitor. The complainant is represented by no one. The DPP doesn't represent her because the DPP's job is to run a prosecution on behalf of the state. But they mustn't be seen to be coaching or in any way supporting one of their witnesses. So the person who's making the complaint, who's often in their very first time in court, and they're in a criminal court where they are opposed by somebody with this team and they have nobody. So in those cases, there is no fair balance in the way that their version of events is put to the jury. And so we made the point that they must be entitled to support. They must be entitled to legal assistance. Occasionally, they can't. There's one special situation where they get it at the moment. But we're saying that should be extended so that both sides can put their own version of events fairly to the jury, and the jury can make a good decision. So the Minister for Justice started a review, and he is running a review at the moment. And into that review, they are going to look to see what are the ways in which you can have someone, a complainant, coming into court, someone who is going to the trouble and all the trauma of going to court in order to make a complaint against an accused person. How can you make it in such a way that the court experience itself doesn't actually re-traumatise them all over again? Because that's what happens at the moment. So that review is going on and is likely to be concluded towards the end of this year. So we're hoping that, I mean, what we say and what others say will be taken into account as well, and that the justice system can be one where justice is done for the complainant as well as for the accused. We don't want to take away anyone's rights. We just want to make sure that if the jury are hearing two versions of an event, that they hear them both fairly.
And of course, we have to stress as well, Noeline, that my guest is Noeline Blackwell, CEO of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, that you are a solicitor as well, Noeline, so you have real, I suppose, up close and personal experience of being in court, yeah. So you know exactly how the system works.
And actually, one of the things that's useful that when I bring my own solicitor's experience into it is that when I was in private practice, I did an awful lot of family law work as well, and some refugee work. And in both of these cases, you're dealing with very, very intimate things for people. And the same is true in relation to whether or not there was consent to sexual activity. They're terribly intimate. So if it was, say, a case of divorce, and issues were coming up around somebody's contact, just like it is down here, thanks be to God, at least our cases are heard without the public gaze. The public are not allowed in to our rape trials, for instance, whereas they are up north, but they're not here. But in a family law case, a private family law case, around divorce, around child protection, in all of these cases, both parties are represented. And we're used to that. We're used to recognising that nobody, except lawyers, are used to going into court to talk about their sex lives. Do you know, it's just not one of the things you expect to be doing. And the court only wants to hear about the law in relation to your sex life. So it's just really one of those things where the capacity of people to tell the story in a way that's useful in the legal context means that you don't leave somebody swimming entirely on their own, unknowing of what they are facing. And in a criminal trial, it's even worse, because the accused is, of course, going to make the best possible case for themselves. Of course they are. They could end up in jail if they're convicted of a crime. And so, therefore, it is often in their interest to attack the credibility of the complainant, of the woman, to say, no, you got it wrong. No, you're this kind of a person. You're doing me harm. You're out to get me. You're malicious and the rest of it. That's in a sense, what else would you expect an accused to do who's fighting for their liberty a lot of the time? But to put that person then in to get that attack without somebody managing that in a way that ensures that the complainant is properly heard as well is really something that we have to get beyond in the 21st century. If we want people to come forward who have suffered sexual violence, we have to make the court a place where they can do it without having themselves eviscerated. And in order to do that, we have to have a fair system where they can be heard fairly and that their rights, as well as the rights of the accused, are properly preserved.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, we all have anecdotal evidence of even down to what you were wearing on the night being an issue in a rape trial.
So all of that. And when you think about it, the jury are only, like, the jury have no other experience either of what it is like. So they go in, and if somebody keeps, addressing, what were you doing? Why were you wearing that skirt? How much did you have to drink? Why were you walking on that road on your own? Did you agree to kiss him, didn't you? Therefore, you know, what else did you expect? Like, how are they, unless they get it heard fairly by both sides, they go in with whatever knowledge they have as well. So actually, I think one of the things that we really feel in relation to this review is it is about ensuring that the victim gets to tell their version of what happened on a particular time in a fair way. It's partly that as well. But there is also something about ensuring that our lawyers, our judges, are properly trained, because a lot of them don't really understand either what is involved in rape. And, like, actually, the law on it is clear enough, but I just think we haven't got it into our heads properly. Like, the law is really clear that sexual activity must be free and voluntary. And if it isn't, it's criminal. You know, so it's not the stranger pulling somebody down, I mean, it's that as well, pulling somebody down a dark alley that they don't know and attacking them sexually. That's part of it. But the vast majority of sexual offences are not committed in that way. They're committed when somebody may consent to one form of sexual activity and the other person doesn't stop when the person is no longer agreeing to that activity. It happens where somebody doesn't even bother to ask consent of their partner or of somebody they're working with. They don't ensure that it is, not even ensure, they don't even know that sexual activity must be free, consent must be freely given, and it must be voluntary. And that's kind of a mindset for all of us, Tony. We all have to sort of pull back and say, do we totally understand that? And a lot of people would say to me, you haven't said it to me, but I'm going to say that a lot of people would say to me, so what, am I supposed to have a written contract every time now I have, you know, sex with my spouse or my long-term partner or something? Well, no, but you are expected to know that they are consenting, freely consenting and voluntarily consenting every single time. And that's actually quite a shift in the way we all think.
Before we leave the legal and the court scenario, Nolene, mandatory sentencing. Now, I know it's a red flag to judges because they'd like to think that they have total autonomy in their own court. And I do know, for argument's sake, that you can get up to life imprisonment for rape.
Yeah.
But the only mandatory sentencing, now I'm sure with your vast legal knowledge, you will correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the only mandatory sentencing in this country revolves around murder, that it's a mandatory life sentence.
Yeah.
In relation to rape, Nolene, do you think that maybe I'm probably grasping at straws here, because I'm looking at figures. I follow what you say in the media and other outlets on a fairly regular basis, and I find that I'm looking, I suppose, really to see where would we find a deterrent. Now, I mean, the people should know the difference between right and wrong, but it's obvious by the amount of rape trials we see that a lot of people don't.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to grasp maybe as, would mandatory sentencing be a possible deterrent? Now, again, where are we with it and will it fly with the judiciary?
Yeah, so I don't actually think it's the best way forward. First of all, they find all the research that's there, which isn't a huge amount of research, but all the research says the biggest deterrent in this type of crime is the fear of getting caught. And because people don't report sexual offences enough, there isn't much fear of getting caught. But in relation to sentencing, sentencing is one of those so mandatory sentencing would be where it would be like, say, the Californian system or those American systems where, say, three strikes and you're out, or if you have a second offence, you must get a minimum sentence of a certain amount of time. I don't believe that they work. And this isn't just a personal opinion. I've looked at work of great people like the Irish Penal Reform Trust, which is which aims to reform the penal system. And I've even looked at the Law Reform Commission work, which is our own government's think tank in relation to this. And they do not come down in favour of mandatory sentencing because a few things happen. In order to avoid giving a mandatory sentence sometimes, a jury will say, well, no, I don't actually think they deserve 10 years because it's their second offence, or life because it's their third offence, so I won't convict them at all, or I'll convict them of a lesser sentence. Or sometimes people won't even be charged with an offence if the prosecution thinks they might end up with a 10-year sentence. But that doesn't mean that I think our sentencing system works as it is right now. Rather than mandatory sentencing, judges do need more guidance than they have at the moment. For themselves, first of all, because the range of sentences seems to me to be too wide, that sometimes sentences are too lenient and for the wrong reason. And also, as somebody going into court, if they're going to go into the jaws of the criminal justice system, they roughly want to know what will be the outcome if the accused gets a conviction. So instead of mandatory sentencing, I really think we need to drive forward with two things. One is a sentencing database, which need be no more than an Excel sheet, just a list of all of the charges brought, all of the decisions made, and then you would be able to see right across the country, whoever the judge was, whatever the court was, that there was what the range of sentencing actually was. Years ago, in the early part of the 21st century, up to about in the 2004, 2005, that kind of time, they started building a sentencing database, which they called the Irish Sentencing the acronym of it was ISIS, which you couldn't have anymore because ISIS has been taken over. But it was a sentencing database where they were starting to stack up all of the decisions so that every single judge could refer to that database and know what the parameters were of, say, a charge of rape, a sentence where somebody had aggravated sexual assault or the rest. So and then that was stopped with the recession. It needs to be reinstated really fast and built up again. And the second thing that we need then is sentencing guidelines. So here, there are sentencing guidelines. This I understand. The Supreme Court and the Court of Appeal have, in big, long, 100-page judgments, set out guidelines for other judges. Now, it may well be that every other judge reads them assiduously before they make a decision. Maybe they do. One thing I know for certain sure is that somebody outside of the courts cannot know from those what the guidelines are. In the UK, in England and Wales, it's a totally different system. A panel comes together. It includes judges, a lot of judges, but not all judges. It includes the police. It includes victims' rights people. It includes social workers. It includes a whole load of people. And they sit down and they produce a document which sets out the guidelines that a judge must take into account when sentencing. And this would have the value of helping a judge, but it would also be something that I could give to somebody who walks into this centre and says, I'm thinking of reporting the rape that I've just suffered. What will happen if this goes to court? I'd be able to show them the guidelines, which are in ordinary English, and say these are the things that the court will take into account when it's passing a sentence if the accused person is convicted. And those things would matter much more and give better outcomes than mandatory sentences. Although it's really hard to dissuade the politicians from mandatory sentencing because it looks like an easy number for them.
And Nolan, just in relation to that, I don't want to take up the whole conversation with the courts, but it is, of course, an integral part of it for people. Mm-hmm. And I presume there should be, it's my opinion, that there should be, I suppose, as aware and as au fait with what's going to happen as any part of the procedure. But are judges who sit on rape trials, are they given any special training? Because, as you said, it is a pretty intimate details being discussed in court. So are judges given any special training when it comes to how to handle and how to conduct a rape trial?
Not mandatory. Some of them will do training. Some of them will come from practice. So some of them will have done criminal law work themselves in the course of their work and will be quite familiar with it. Excuse me. In my view, they too should be trained because, when you're doing the work over a number of years, you develop your own biases, your own beliefs. And I believe they should be doing training as well. But our judiciary are not required to do training at all. They're required to sit in on various cases. Excuse me, sorry. So they are required to sit in at the start, but they're not required to do training in this area. Some of them are much more familiar with the area than others. But it's one of the areas where it is a challenge that the lawyers and the judges often are no better informed on the various perspectives in a case than the members of the jury. And that is a problem.
Nolan, to move away from that, and we'll park that side of the discussion for today, though I've no doubt we'll be returning to it in the future. But a word you mentioned there, and a phrase or whatever you want to attribute to it, consent. Now, we have seen in the recent times, and maybe even the not-so-recent times, but it's been very prevalent recently, the work done at third level in colleges surrounding consent.
Yes. So that is fantastic work, very often student-driven. Nearly always student-driven across the various colleges. The Union of Students in Ireland has done and is continuing to do superb work in this area. The colleges that are not in the Union of Students, like UCD, also doing great work in this area. Cork is kind of an exception in that the college, the institution, is leading this work themselves. And what the reason for the work, though, is it's crisis-driven. It is because the level at which young people, because it's mostly young people who are in the colleges, are going into third-level education, are going into a time of unprecedented freedom, unprecedented chances to explore themselves, their society, who they mix with, what they ingest in terms of their food and drink and drugs, in terms of how they manage their lives at a time where they are normally experimenting sexually as well. And what the colleges have found over recent years is that as a result of that, youngsters are going in without any proper understanding of how to handle their emotions and themselves in encounters where they're exploring sexual activity. And what the colleges did, really they caught on very fast, was the need to sit students down and have students talk about themselves around what is right and what is wrong. Because so many of them are coming from second level without any understanding of that from their schools. They're not talking about it at home, or even if their parents try to introduce it, they're not even slightly prepared to talk to their parents about it. Very often what they're getting now is from the internet, from pornography, and they don't have that sort of understanding that they do in so many other areas. So for instance, while people will still physically assault each other and have physical fights, most people know they're not supposed to do it, and they will also have friends who will pull them away, you know, if they're getting into a fight after too much drink on a Friday night or whatever. But in relation to sexual activity, they don't have that deep understanding of what is and is not acceptable. And it all comes down to that one simple concept of consent. Do not engage in sexual activity unless your partner is truly consenting. And make sure that you understand that you're listening to your partner to ensure that that consent is there on the one hand, and then giving students the knowledge and the language around consent. We were very grateful to Body and Soul, who gave us a free stand down at their festival down in County Westmeath over the summer. And as part of our safe space tent, we asked the people who were going, mostly young people, kind of college age, to put up what they wish they had known earlier. And what nearly all of them wished they had known earlier was that they could say no, or that they had stopped earlier, or that they had language around communication. So communication is really poor for an awful lot of youngsters. And they don't literally know what's acceptable and what's not. These, for the most part, are great kids. They've got the places to go to their college. They've worked hard for it. And they want to go, and they want to have a great life, and they want to have the parties, and they're all of that they should be able to do. But if they could only do it within those boundaries of consensual activity, they'll stay safe themselves and they will make others safe as well.
You mentioned there, Nolly, and I was going to allude to it later on in our chat, but seeing as you alluded to it, we'll go to it now. The internet and you know, young adults and children accessing their sex education from the internet. Yep. And I know, Nolene, in my heart and soul, that some newspaper is going to lead with the headline, Nolene Blackwell, CEO of the Dublin Rape Crisis, says there should be pornography in schools.
Well, now it's in today's Irish Daily Mail. I just think that we work so hard for our young people now. You know, like, children have rarely parents have rarely been more conscious of the duties and obligations of parenting, and ensuring that, for the most part, that children have the opportunities that they need as they're growing up. So, you know, they get the intellectual formation that they need in schools. They get a lot of their physical formation in schools, in sporting clubs, in all of that. And we have to recognize that their emotional development is equally important. And the harm that can be done by ignoring that emotional development is greater than ever now, because they have so much information available to them elsewhere. And the trouble with pornography is that it is incorrect information. But if you don't give children other balances, how are they to know it is incorrect? For all of us, that's even true of you and me, Donny. When we're having this conversation here, people will have to listen to us and decide whether we're making sense or not. And they'll probably listen to other people who will disagree with us, and they'll have to make, you know, decisions about what they accept, what they might explore further, what they absolutely refuse to accept. So if you're a youngster, and, you know, one of the things you probably don't want to talk about is your emotional health, because there's so many things going on as a teenager and the rest of it. Well, then who has the responsibility to make sure that your emotional health is being properly managed? When you give, or when children, you don't have to give them a smartphone anymore, when they have access to so much wrong information, to so much incorrect information, I would say pornography is only part of that wrong information. It's the stuff around body image as well, you know, all of those nasty, incorrect, unreal situations need to be balanced with real life. And we've seen it done. We have seen where, because we run a program for teachers and guidance counselors called Body Right, and they come in and they learn how to, I don't know, form, or yeah, it's a bit of emotional formation for youngsters in relation to healthy relationships, in respect, in relation to respect for themselves, respect for others. It's just a way of, I suppose, giving them a set of norms that they can manage their lives better. And when we see that done, it is amazing how confident then youngsters are, boys and girls, when they understand that this is perfectly all right. It is okay to be respectful, that respect is what real life is about. They're more comfortable in that space then than in the space where they have the unreal expectations that they get from the internet. In the old days, it wasn't that pornography wasn't around, but it was balanced by so many other things and it was so limited. Now it is so available. Whether you want it or not, it is so easy to access that kind of information. And young people are being targeted as well in relation to it, because they are vulnerable and they lack the life experience that they need, which is why, again, we love to see the colleges doing the consent classes, in doing the consent workshops, in working with young people, young boys, girls, young people coming through into an area where they're learning all about their own emotions. And in this new freedom, we love to see them doing that. We believe it should start sooner. And now, of course, having started saying it should be in secondary school, we really think consent, not about sexual activity, but just the whole idea of consent, really starts when children are very, very small. Am I comfortable with doing something? Am I checking that the other person is comfortable with it? If you think about it, a good understanding of consent, of respect for yourself and respect for others, would be so helpful in relation to bullying, in relation and being bullied, in relation to so many ways that children are growing up over time. But in sexual activities, they're not hearing the healthy stuff. They are seeing and hearing the unhealthy stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, we don't obviously, Nolene, want to panic or create scaremongering among parents, but I did hear something recently where it was, the theory was put forward that children and young people are only two clicks away from any pornographic site once they have a smartphone or access to a laptop. So,
And they wouldn't be the only ones. Some of the things that you can put into your own phone if you're doing a search, you know, I have occasionally come up with an eye-watering site with what I thought was a perfectly normal search. So these things are possible. But for the rest of us, we can make decisions based on experience, based on knowledge, based on what we've learned about relationships over time. So again, it's just one of the things that we have to address. I totally respect people who say, I don't want my children learning about these things too young. All of that is exactly right. So this isn't an all or nothing thing. This is age-appropriate information in relation to healthy relationships over the course of an education is one of the best investments you can make in your children.
I thoroughly agree with you. And also, spend as much time as you can with them. And
yeah, but you know, they really don't want, teenagers do not want to talk to owl ones about, you know, their sexual and emotional relationships. So there has to be, it can't just be in the home. It has to be in the school place. It has to be in sporting places, and I do think they have such capacity. Sports clubs, organisations where young people gather have such capacity because they do engage in physical and emotional formation. You know, when children and young people are being taught to be part of a team, to be part of a joint endeavour, to do something together, those are occasions where you're forming the emotions. And those two have huge capacity in order to ensure that they are respectful places in relation to sexual activity as well, where you can do it as part of just forming young people's activities in as they move forward into young adulthood.
Nolan, to move it along a little bit, and again, I am so grateful to you for providing us with this amount of time this morning, because I know that...
Always such a pleasure to talk to you, Donny.
You're very kind, but I do know that there are huge demands on your time. But there is an increase in the level of reporting of sexual assaults. Now, we might maybe move away from the term rape and just use the umbrella term sexual assaults. There is an increase. And I'm just wondering, now we alluded earlier on to the Belfast rape trial, and again, as I said, there was nobody found guilty in relation to that. At the time, there was a huge concern, and I remember you particularly, when chatting to me that time, you expressed a worry that maybe because of the media coverage surrounding that it might put people off reporting sexual assault. We see that there is an increase, and I'm just wondering, Nolene, how much has the Me Too movement led to that, or are there other contributing factors?
Yes, well, it is definitely a continuing trend. The number of sexual offences is going up year on year. Mind you, it remains at about 2,000, which seems to me, if the evidence is that this is one of the most endemic and systemic crimes in our society, and that seems to be the evidence, then 2,000 is still a very small number of offences reported annually.
Nolan, can I just stop you on that? I don't want to contradict you, but for the population that we have, and it's just a point I will put to you, that if you had 2,000 murders per year, there'd be absolute mayhem. But 2,000 sexual assaults, you know what I mean? Like, it's... I don't want to say that it's almost giving the deaf ear, but, you know, if you had 2,000 people killed on our roads, if you had, as I said, 2,000 murders, but there are these are 2,000 sexual assaults. And I mean, and I don't want to turn this into a legal bore fest, but next to murder, rape and sexual assault is the next most serious crime.
Exactly. Now, the 2,000 sexual offences... They wouldn't all be rape, but there are a lot. There is still about 600 rape offences reported in the course of the year. So it is still a massive number of people. Donny, I'm absolutely with you on that one. If it was taken as seriously as even dangerous driving, not to talk of murder and manslaughter, if it was taken that seriously, and if it was reported enough, then you'd have a change in behaviour. But also, I think people would be absolutely shocked. So the rise in reporting, just to kind of get back to that bit of it, is interesting. One of the real problems about the rise in reporting is that not just us, but nobody that we know, including the guards and the Central Statistics Office, nobody can say, is that due to an increase in people reporting or an increase in the level of sexual violence? And the problem is that we lack good base information. But it is something, at least, that the number of reports is going up. And definitely Me Too had something to do with it, because to this day on the phone, we are still getting people who are saying, I'm reluctant to report because... I know what going into the criminal justice system means. So that hasn't gone away. But the balancing thing of Me Too was that a lot of people who had suffered sexual assaults and sexual harassment now felt that there were other people in the same boat as themselves. They were not isolated. And they now, instead of feeling immediately that they wouldn't be believed, they now felt, I may be believed. There's a chance I will be believed. And that has made a huge difference. We know that that has made a difference. We can see from the people who contact us. You could always contact our helpline, and you could contact one of the 16 rape crisis centres around the country, and you could get non-judgmental, confidential support. But we can see now, at a much bigger level, more people are prepared to say, this happened to me. I know that enough people will believe me to make it reasonable for me to say it. Whereas before, an awful lot of people felt isolated, felt that this happened to nobody else and that nobody would believe them if they said it. So Me Too has been relevant in our society because it has swung people to recognise that it is that it is a scandal that sexual assault is at the level it is at, and that it is scandalous behaviour, and that you are allowed to say it happened, that it wasn't your fault, and that you will be believed.
And Nolene, I remember doing an interview with you in relation to another programme that we did here, the Respect Wards in relation to migrants, etc. And that. And it's just something that comes from that last little bit of a chat we had. And at the time, I remember that we alluded to it. I don't even know whether we alluded to it on air or off air, but the position in relation to a lot of people who are here, maybe not 100% legally, we'll just say, who are the victims of rape, and that they would not report rape. Do you think that maybe the increase might be due to the fact that some people in those communities are now feeling empowered and that they are reporting?
I would like to know more about that. And that's another reason why we so badly need more research into the area. I think we have not got a great understanding of who is reporting yet. And that's why we need this survey called Savvy 2 that you, anytime you and I have spoken, Tony, it has come up and we mention it the whole time. Back in 2002, there was a deep dive done into Irish society, a big survey done called Sexual Abuse and Violence in Ireland, which got the nickname Savvy, which was a great nickname, back in 2002, which identified a whole lot about sexual violence, because you can't just actually walk up to somebody and say, hey, by the way, do you want to tell me, were you ever the victim of a sexual assault? You know, you might be able to say that. You might be able to say, was your phone ever stolen? Was your car ever stolen? But you can't really just walk up to somebody and say that. And you can't even include it that easily into a survey that you do over the phone with someone. Why would they answer a private question like that? So that was done back in 2002. But Ireland, and the recommendation was that it would be done every 5 years afterwards. And if that had been done, we would have a really great idea of who the victims of sexual violence were in Ireland today, what the trends were people getting younger, which is what we suspect, were people reporting more, were people from more diverse backgrounds suffering rape or noticing that there were victims of rape and sexual assault. But it was never done again. In December last year, our Christmas present at the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre last year was when the Minister for Justice announced that they were going to do a scoping exercise to look at what needed to be surveyed now in order to get an understanding of sexual violence in Ireland today. So that scoping study was done. The reports were in last April. We've been anxiously waiting for an announcement from the Minister for Justice about it since. He has said that he will make an announcement in the next few weeks. And he also said after the budget that resources would not be the issue this year. And so we're going to get another, hopefully, a good study done in 2019, which will help us to understand who is reporting in Ireland. Ireland, are people reporting right across the areas? Are older people reporting now that wouldn't have reported before? Are younger people? Are people from new communities reporting? Are men reporting more? You know, all of that. So, are disclosing more or even suffering sexual violence? So, that big study is essential if I'm to give you a straight answer to the question you asked me about 10 minutes ago, which was, are people who are undocumented or new migrants into Ireland, are they reporting more? We know some are reporting. We know some are coming to Ireland with huge experience of trauma, of sexual trauma behind them. A lot of the people who are coming into Ireland, either invited in by the government or coming as asylum seekers, have suffered huge sexual violence either in their country of origin or on their way to Ireland as they fled dangerous situations. So we know about those for sure. We know about some others as well, but we really don't have a great understanding. And you see, the thing about it is, it's not just that we want to know or that we want to be able to tell you so you can tell your listeners, but also for the government, who is spending money on combating sexual violence in Ireland, not to know enough about it is kind of madness, because that means they're spending money without having the evidence they need to make good policy. So the sooner they do it, the sooner it'll be in the taxpayers' interest as well as in the interest of those who've suffered sexual violence.
Yes, and of course it has to be stated, Noeline, that, and we have seen this... it's not for the first time, of course. It's a years old thing where sexual violence, rape, etc., have been weaponized in certain countries. Noeline, before we part company on this occasion, I want you to talk to me about something which I feel you are. I was going to say passionate, but I think it's a little bit more than passionate about. You are questioning the divisional protective units, and in fact you were just asking straight out, we were promised them, where the hell are they?
Yeah, exactly right. So one of the things, again, in the same way that you can't rock up to somebody in a survey and say, where your victim of sexual violence, the investigation of sexual violence and domestic violence by the police is a specialist job. Okay, one of the things that we note as well is that every single person in the police system should be able to take a report of sexual violence in a trained way, in a way that understands the trauma of it and deals with it. But for serious sexual violence and domestic violence, you need specialised investigation. And the way that the guards themselves determined that this would be done is that they would put a specialist unit into each one of the 28 divisions around the country. That would deal with kind of the most serious cases, but would also inform everybody else in the division as well. So 28 divisions. And for at least 2 or 3 years, those 28 divisions were each to have a specialist protective services unit. And they were all to be coordinated at the national level. Now, the national level, in fairness, was put in about 2015 and is a central service which is nearly fully staffed, and it may be actually fully staffed at the moment. Of the 28 divisions promised about 3 years ago, 4 have been put in place. 3.5 actually, because one of them is only coming on stream now. They're supposed to be there for the past year. There's one in Cork, which our colleagues in Sexual Violence Cork tell us is not fully staffed. There's 2 in Dublin, 1 in Cabra, 1 in Clondalkin, and there's 1 in Dundalk. But there are 24 divisions that do not have these units. Another 6 are promised in 2018, and I'm here now looking at my calendar, and I see there's about 6 weeks left in this year, about 10 weeks left in this year. And not one of those 6 for 2018 have been put in place yet. But I'm assured they will be put in place. But I'm hoping they will be properly staffed, that they'll have the cars, the technology and the people they need in them. That's not just a token start-up position. But that will still leave 18 units around the country with no specialist support at all. And in some of those places, they can't even identify where physically they could be put. So I think the guards knew exactly what they were doing. They were right in saying they needed specialist units in each one of their divisions in order to ensure that these crimes were properly investigated. They were right about that. They only have four at the moment. That means there's 24 divisions where they cannot be sure that those investigations are being properly carried out because they don't have the specialist expertise that they say they need themselves. And in truth, and this is, I just want to be totally clear about this, some of the Garda stations where people who come to us go, when we accompany people to Garda stations, you get the best, most efficient, most sensitive questioning and investigation that you could possibly hope for. They are absolutely text mark of how it should be done. But we have to say, at the same time, we accompany others as well to places where victims are not treated with respect, where they are not properly interviewed, and where their investigations are not properly carried out. And in an area where the crimes are so serious and so manifest, as we said before, it's just one of those things that really we have to worry about a crime which the Gardaí recognise needs this kind of specialist unit and which doesn't get it.
Well, Nolan, the only thing I can say to you in relation to that, and again, as always, time has run out on us, but you know, if you're talking about a situation where we only had a national unit put in place 3 years ago, I mean, I wouldn't be holding my breath to fill out those remaining 24 divisions, I think.
I've great hopes of the new commissioner. You know, and the Commission on the Future Policing, which I was privileged to sit on, actually, as a member, also did a total review of the way in which Gardaí in the community would operate, and recognise that for the most part, police, you know, need to be on the front line, need to be front facing in their community, preventing harm as best they can. All of that is really relevant to our work as well. So I know that the government has set up an implementation, or is setting up an implementation group in order to, during this year, before the end of the year, to identify how to implement the report on the future of policing. And that is going to be part of the way forward as well. We have to either don't bother calling them crimes or don't bother investigating them, but don't have a situation where some investigations are fantastic and some are so sloppy that they actually lose the investigation in the course of it, that the investigation becomes tainted, that the victim loses hope, and that as a result of that, people who commit serious sexual crimes in our country are not brought to account.
Nolan, thank you so much for your time this morning. You have been incredibly generous. Before you go, for anybody who is affected by our discussion this morning, can you please give out the phone numbers for the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre?
I will indeed. So the National 24-Hour Helpline there day and night is 1800 77 88 88 for anyone impacted. If you've suffered sexual violence, if you're supporting somebody, if you need information, 1800 77 88 88, and someone will be happy to talk to you.
Nolan Blackwell, CEO of the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre. Nolan, thank you so much for joining me on this Monday special of Northside Today. Always a pleasure, Nolan, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Donny. Bye bye.
Bye bye.